sea. Near sunset, they returned, manfully pulling the oars as the dories rode low in the water, heavy with glistening, still wriggling fish. The day's catch was heaved on board and cleaned. Then the headless, gutted herring were shoveled into the ship's hold and packed between layers of salt to preserve them. There was no spare dory for Penelope, and she would not have been strong enough to row her own little boat through choppy seas in any case. Instead, she sat on the deck of the Acorn with her fishing pole and cast her line over the side. Her prey was not herring, but dinner. A nice halibut, a tasty haddock, or even a scrumptious sole would do. Anything to break up the monotony of herring, salt tack, and sauerkraut at every meal. After a few false starts and pricked fingers, she learned to bait her hook with scraps left over from the previous night's cleaning. She failed to catch anything, but she was never bored, for no 2 days were alike. Some mornings the fog came in low and thick, and swirled round the hull like smoke. Other days, dawn so clear, the air shimmered and played tricks on her eyes. Once she could have sworn she saw figures standing on tiptoe on the glittering surface of the water. "Mermaids!" she cried. But it was only a pod of dolphins, balanced upright on their tails. Their smooth, long-nosed heads nodded in time to the music of the sea, once to the right and once to the left, as if taking a bow. They leaped over the swells with the grace of a corps de ballet and plunged into the depths once more. Now and then, a great jellyfish floated by, like an open umbrella made of glass, pulsing its way along just beneath the surface. Further off, whales blew jets of water from their blowholes, like smoke from the smokestack of a bloomer steam locomotive. Only once did a whale come close enough for Penelope to gaze into its unfathomable eye. It was an especially large type of whale, called a sperm whale. From nose to tail, it was as long as the Acorn itself. Fans of whales, books and books about whales, may already be familiar with Moby Dick, by Mr. Herman Melville. This famous story of a sea captain obsessed with a whale is packed with symbolism, suitable for use as a doorstop in a pinch, and well worth reading, too. Penelope learned to scurry up the rope rigging like a squirrel, for there she could sometimes see other boats dotting the horizon, like toys in an enormous bathtub. She learned to stand clear when the boom swung across the deck as the boat changed tack, by angling into the wind till the leeward side of the sails became the windward side, or the other way round. She learned to clean a fish with a carved knife sharper than any sewing needle and save the fish heads for bait. She even learned to navigate a little. The Acorn tacked a zigzag route through the water, searching for where the fish were plentiful. It was the movement of the sun arcing from east to west over the course of a long Nordic day and the whirling of the stars during the brief, dim nights that kept Penelope knowing her right from her left, so to speak. She saw the northern lights, too. Ribbons of pink and green, yellow and purple and blue swirled in the night sky in a miraculous display. Why the sky glows with a whole rainbow of colors near the poles of the earth is a fascinating question. But for once, Penelope did not wonder why. She simply stood in awe. The Aurora Borealis. How she longed for the incorrigible children to see it. But perhaps they would get the chance. Someday. Breakfast and lunch she ate alone, for the men were out in the dories and Captain Strom stayed at the helm, poring over the sea charts. At dinner, they all gathered at a long wooden table below decks. There she learned the fisherman's way of saying grace before a meal, which Alf translated for her. "We give thanks for fish in the sea, and more thanks for the fish in the hold. Most of all, thanks for the fish on the plate. Down the hatch they go." They all slapped their bellies at the last line. This was the cue to begin eating. After dinner, the men would sing, accompanied by tin whistles and the bittersweet pluck of mandolin strings. The shanties the crew sang during the day were rhythmic work songs, good for keeping time as they hauled rope and shoveled herring into the hold. But the songs sung after dinner were full of longing and woe. Penelope could not understand the words, but she imagined they told tales of lost loves, shipwrecks, and fish that got away. Each night she sat in the corner of an upended bucket, eyes closed. The music washed over her and filled her with the kind of sadness that satisfies the heart the way a good meal satisfies the belly. A touch of melancholy is to be expected aboard ship, as sailors spend most of their lives far from home. It is a hard life and a lonely one, and yet she thought of Simon and his great love of the sea, which she had now begun to understand. It does have its charms. In this way the days passed. Soon Penelope had spent more than a week at sea. From the sun and stars, she knew they were heading in the right direction, at least. From the moon, she knew she was running out of time. One night, she awoke with a start. She had dreamed that the man in the moon had Edward Ashton's face and followed her everywhere she went. It took a few deep calming breaths and some basic astronomy for her to recover, for it happened to be the night of the new moon when the last sliver of waning crescent is snuffed out and the moon is invisible to the eye. "For tonight, at least, there is no one watching and nothing to fear," she told herself. "Yet if tonight is the new moon, it has been 2 weeks and a day since I left Plinkst, and there are only 2 weeks left till the first full moon of May, when Lady Constance is due to give birth. How will I ever get back to England in time?" There was no going back to sleep after that. Near dawn, she finally dozed off, but by then it was time to get up and get to work. Thus preoccupied with worry and hazy-minded from lack of sleep, Penelope gathered her fishing pole, bait, and bucket. The dories were still neatly stacked, the sun was above the horizon, and the weather was fair enough, if breezy, but the men had not gone out to fish. Some were doing chores on deck or in the galley, but most were down in the hold, packing the salted herring into empty barrels. She might have wondered why this was so, but her mind was still on the moon. Penelope settled in her usual spot, pole in hand, and watched her cork fishing float dance on the water's surface. If a fish bit the hook, the float would get pulled under. Her job was to wait for this momentous event to occur, after which she would do her best to reel in the fish. That was the idea, at least. So far, the float had only gone down when her line tangled in seaweed, or because a sea crab had nibbled at the bait until there was only a thread of grizzle left. Then she had to start over by putting a fresh fish head on the hook and casting it out once more. Before long, Alf appeared at her side. He glanced into the bucket of seawater she kept at her feet, in case she caught anything. "Not yet," she said in answer to his quizzical look, "but I am beginning to feel quite close to catching a fish. Today might just be the day." "Nope," Alf jerked his head toward the helm. "Strom," he said. All the men referred to the captain as Strom. Two words would be one word too many for a man so silent. Penelope put down her pole and made off at a trot, for by now she knew that walking was no way for a sailor to obey a summons from the captain. Strom was at the wheel, gazing outward. He stood with ease, as if the ship was in a dead calm, but the seas were choppy from the playful wind. "Look," he said, pointing south. She peered. A faint haze blurred the horizon. "Land! Is that England?" she asked in hope.
"Nay."
His crinkled eyes narrowed to icy blue slits.
"Queen of fish? Ah, goodbye."
The breeze gusted and salt spray blew in her face. "I realize my fishing skills are not up to professional standards, but surely I will improve with practice," she said. It was not easy to talk while trying to keep her balance, but if Strom could stand there without holding on, so could she. He turned his trouser pockets inside out, showing them to be empty.
"No pay," he said, as if to remind her how she got herself into this mess. Then he pantomimed reeling in a fish and finding nothing on the hook. "No fish," he waved at Penelope. "Bye-bye," he said.
"This is an unfortunate misunderstanding," she said, tottering. The weave and bob of the ship made her stomach churn. Without thinking, she reached out to steady herself, but in doing so, she fell upon the wheel with both hands.
"Whoops!"
she cried, but it was too late. Unwittingly, she had pulled the ship hard to port. The salt casks toppled and rolled, and the men shouted and cursed as the boom swung wildly across the deck, knocking them over like bowling pins.
"Oof!" Strom roared.
Seconds later, Alf appeared, sporting a fresh bruise on his head. The Acorn's captain let out a rare stream of angry words. He pointed at Penelope and made a gesture with one thumb that seemed to indicate being tossed overboard. Alf nodded, looking grim. He led Penelope back to her bunk and told her to collect her things.
"I wonder how one says jetsam in Norwegian, for I fear that is what I am about to become," she thought. "Or perhaps they will make me walk the plank, as pirates do. Dear me, I ought to have learned to swim when I had the chance."
Penelope's few possessions, including her broken tiara, her ruined princess costume, and her papier-mâché seashell, were already in her bag.
"If the Count of Monte Cristo could be buried at sea and live to tell the tale, then so can I. Once in the briny deep, I shall paddle with all my might and wait for another ship to come by. Perhaps I will meet some friendly smugglers before too long."
Luckily, Strom was no pirate. In fact, he would have been deeply offended at the idea. While Penelope fretted, the Acorn's captain set course for the not-so-distant shore, where he planned to sell off some fish and buy provisions, as well as get rid of his accidental passenger. Whether she was a royal relation or not, he did not know or care. But when it came to fishing, the girl had bad luck. And that was something he could not allow, not on his ship, not with a half-empty hold and a crew of men to feed. Once the ship was anchored, Alf and Penelope climbed into a dory, and he rowed her to the shore. The rest of the crew was too busy shoveling herring into barrels while singing rhythmic sea shanties to even say goodbye. Alf sang under his breath as well, in time to the strokes of his oars. At the dock, he lashed the dory to a post with rope. Penelope could not help but admire the quick, expert way he tied his sailor knots. How the incorrigible children would have enjoyed seeing it. He offered a hand to help her climb out, but she had acquired enough sailor's pride to insist on doing it herself. Once she was on land, the ground under her feet felt weirdly still.
"Where are we?" she asked.
"Frankenfurt."
Alf hopped down into the dory to get her bag. He was so light-footed the little rowboat hardly moved.
"Frankenfurt," she repeated, trying to imagine where that might be. "I don't suppose that is in England, is it?"
"Nope, Germany."
Her heart sank. Germany. It was better than Russia, but still, so very far from home. Alf held the damp, sea-stained carpet bag at arm's length. Its fluffy coating of white feathers was flattened with salt spray, making it look and smell convincingly like a large white seabird, or the remains of one.
"Nope, nope, nope,"
he scolded as he handed it to Penelope. Everyone knew that a dead albatross was bad luck aboard ship. No wonder little Princess Stowaway never caught anything. If Penelope had expected Alf to help her get her bearings before leaving her alone in a strange country, she would have been disappointed. Once rid of her and her unlucky charm, he turned and strode off with purpose. The first mate's next stop would be the fish market, to see what price could be gotten for the Acorn's herring.
"Alf, wait!"
she called, hurrying after him. His rolling sailor's gait made him think of Simon, and she felt a pang of despair. Would she ever get home to Ashton Place?
"I am truly sorry for all the trouble I have caused," she said, breathlessly trying to keep pace. "Is there any way to get Captain Strom to reconsider bringing me to England? They do eat a great deal of herring there."
"Nope," he said, still walking. And that was the last time she saw Alf. The 11th chapter. A tiny bookshop has what Penelope needs. Unlike Miss Penelope Lumley, Edward Ashton had no need of disguises and trickery to get from one place to the next, for he had money, and plenty of it. He hired expert drivers with carriage horses fleet-footed enough to win the Derby. He paid triple the usual fare to book passage on a ship that was already packed snug as a tin of herring. Privately, he paid still more to the captain to make sure they would travel at full sail, no matter the weather. Once ashore, he bought a first-class ticket for the sleek new steam engine trains that now crisscrossed Europe. Whether this could be considered progress or not was a matter of opinion. He had boarded the train in France, near Calais. Already, he had passed into Germany. During the same days, Penelope had spent aboard the Acorn, fishing and pondering the vastness of the sea. Edward Ashton, too, had been on the move, and he had covered a great deal of ground.
"By now, I expect the governess has found a way out of Plinkst," he thought, gazing out the train window at the scenery flashing by. It was a lush and mysterious landscape, a dense wood of dizzyingly tall fir trees that covered the rolling mountains like a living blanket of green.
"She is misguided and naive, but the girl has pluck. She would move the Black Forest itself to reach the wolf children before the first full moon of May."
The image of Penelope reunited with the incorrigibles made his pulse race. How often he had imagined doing them in, and in such a gruesome variety of ways. But in the end, it would not matter how they perished. What mattered was that they all did. All five of them. The wheels slowed, clickety-clack, find the fifth, clickety-clack, find the fifth. As the motorman applied the brake and the train made its way around a steep mountain curve. If only he could slow his mind so easily. Too often it spun like a cyclone, the faces of the governess and her three wolfish charges whirling behind his eyes until he could no longer see what was before him. He drew his black cloak snugly around, as if making himself into a shadow.
"There was no time to deal with the girl in Russia, as I had intended, but she will come home of her own accord, like a well-trained dog. The wolf children are already in hand. The fifth lies elsewhere with its parents. This time I will not, I cannot, fail."
The guidebook, full of clues that had led him to Switzerland, had been nothing but a red herring. All that precious time wasted, searching for the Lumleys, where they were not. But no matter. Now, thanks to that idiot Gogolev, his luck had changed. A far more valuable book had come into his hands. Really, what were the odds? And the truth had been revealed. Imagine a clue of such magnitude hidden in plain sight, right on the opening pages. Melancholy poems, indeed, had not felt so, well, optimistic in years.
"I wander through the meadows green," he murmured to himself and smiled.
For now he was certain. His long-lost prey was in Germany, in a small coastal village named... But surely you can guess where he was going. He had not arrived yet, as the connecting train from Gudenbaden had been delayed. A flock of furious pheasants was blocking the tracks and stubbornly refused to move. This was unexpected, as pheasants are usually quite docile birds, and tasty, too.
But rest assured, he was on his way. "Willkommen in Frankenfurt."
It was an attractive sign, as signs go. The words, which Penelope correctly understood to mean, "Welcome to Frankenfurt," were written in graceful, looping letters on a panel of wood, with a painted border of green leaves and small white flowers.
A town that strives to make such a good first impression must surely be a friendly place, she thought. Curious, I thought Edelweiss only grew in the mountains, but the pictures are charming nevertheless. As you see, she was trying to keep her spirits up. It was not easy. Optimistically speaking, she had escaped Russia and now merely needed to hop, skip, and jump to that happy land where Victoria was queen. Yet the hard, pessimax truth of the matter found her stranded and penniless in a mid-sized European nation where she did not speak the language, wearing boys' clothes and smelling of fish. She was nearer to her destination than she had been, but oh, England! Home was still so very far away. She racked her brains for all she could remember about European geography. What stood between her and Ashton Place? Was it the Alps, the Black Forest, the beautiful blue Danube? At least there are no scorching hot deserts in the way, as there might be in Africa, she thought. What luck, not a single deadly cobra lies in my path. You see how desperate she was to look on the bright side, but it was only a modest stroke of luck not to have to trudge across the burning sands of the Sahara when she still had half of Europe to get across, and the English Channel, too. Think, Penny. An atlas would come in useful. Some money, too. And food, she realized, for she was terribly hungry, and the closer she got to town, the more her mouth began to water. Either it was her imagination, or Frankenford smelled deliciously of cake. She hoisted her carpet bag from one hand to the other, and resumed walking. She followed the scent just as the incorrigible children would. Soon she found herself in the village square, in front of a perfectly charming bakery with a large, street-facing window. What glorious desserts lay within, so close and yet so utterly out of reach! It reminded her of the line from Mr. Coleridge's strange poem about the ancient mariner and the albatross. Water, water, everywhere, and all the boards did shrink. Water, water, everywhere, nor any drop to drink. Cake, cake, everywhere, and not a slice for me. She recited, using her poetic license, to make the poem fit her own circumstances more neatly. She pressed her nose to the glass and stared at the muffins and biscuits, the trays of tarts, and the magnificent Black Forest cakes, thickly frosted in snow-white icing with crowns of cherries and shaved dark chocolate on top. Then she caught a glimpse of her reflection, bedraggled and wide-eyed. Reluctantly, she backed away from the glass. I look like a runaway cabin boy, she thought. If I am seen lurking around, I am likely to be turned over to the police. What to do? She had no money, no plan, no hope, and no Black Forest cake. The situation was bleak. She turned to go. But where? Ring, 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 ring. A bell jingled as a customer left the establishment next to the bakery. Penelope had been so distracted by her own misery that she had not even noticed the shop next door. She looked in the window, and her carpet bag slipped to the ground. Books! She exclaimed, and not just any books. Here was a whole series of books, lovingly displayed in an artful tableau of a pony paddock, with miniature carved and painted pony figures grazing on green velvet grass, and little white fences made of whitewashed twigs lashed together with thread. The titles were all in German, but there was no mistaking the illustrations of Edith Ann Pevington and her beloved pony, Rainbow, on the covers. Penelope's heart swelled as if she had received 1,000 birthday cards all at once.
Ein Gewitterwolk für Regenbogen, she said, pronouncing one of the titles as best she could. That must be a storm cloud for Rainbow. The sad-faced pony in grey skies gave it away. Fans of books about ponies know that a storm cloud for Rainbow is the most melancholy tale in the series. This is not saying much, as the giddy-up Rainbow books incline toward the cheerful. However,
In this episode, Rainbow falls into a funk after losing an important competition and questions the meaning of everything a pony holds dear. Having red ribbons braided through one's mane, prancing obediently through obstacle courses, and taking jumps at a trot. What was it all for? To win a trophy? To please Edith Ann Pevington? Was that all there was to a pony's life? Penelope smiled, then beamed, then laughed aloud, for even the grimiest giddy-up Rainbow Book had joy to spare. "I will go into this bookshop, just to look," she decided. "It may have an atlas if the travel section is well stocked. Perhaps all is not yet lost." Just like that, hope was restored. It was a slither of hope, mind you, thin as the thinnest crescent moon, but sometimes a sliver is all a person needs. The bell jingled softly as she entered. Ring, 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 ring. The shop was tiny, but like all the best bookstores, it gave the distinct impression that whatever book one needed was somewhere within its overflowing shelves. A colourful globe, a real one, mounted on a wooden stand that let it spin as the earth does, led her to the travel section. There, she found a whole shelf of guidebooks to cities near and far, and past and present too. "One for Istanbul and one for Constantinople," she marvelled. "And here is one for Rome and one for ancient Rome. Truly, it is the eternal city." There were maps, an arm's breadth width, that folded like accordions until they could be slipped into a pocket, and dictionaries that translated words from one language into a dozen others. There were memoirs by Arctic explorers, fearless mountaineers, and deep-sea divers who braved the briny deep wearing those new-fangled diving costumes. These were heavy suits with helmets into which air was pumped, allowing a person to breathe underwater. What an invention! And there on its own small desk, propped at an angle on a wooden stand, just waiting to be opened, was a perfectly splendid atlas. Penelope put down her carpet bag and wiped her hands on her sailor pants before touching the beautiful volume. She leafed through the maps until she found Frankenford. Then she turned page after page, examining every bit of terrain that lay between her and where she most longed to be. At first, she thought she must be mistaken. She flipped the pages back and forth. How could there still be so many miles of mountains, rivers, lakes, and forests to march up, down, around, and through? And this before ever reaching the English Channel. That would be a mighty swim, indeed. "It is too far," she blurted. Then she began to cry in earnest, for the truth was as plain as the difference between the right foot and the left, the North Pole and the South, the new moon and the full. With scarcely a week left, there was no possible way she could get back to England in time to save her beloved incorrigibles. Whether Edward Ashton achieved his murderous schemes or the curse upon the Ashtons put a gruesome end to them all hardly mattered. She had failed, and she would never see the children again. Nor would she see Simon, or Miss Mortimer, or Mrs. Clark, or even that dear scamp, Nutsawoo. She wept in that tiny bookshop in Frankenford and rubbed the dirty sleeve of her fisherman's sweater across her wet cheeks and leaky nose. It was a storm cloud for Rainbow indeed. Her shoulders heaved as she tried to quiet her sobs. What she longed to do was howl with grief, long and loud, but that would hardly be good manners in a bookshop.
"Weltschmerz?" a kind voice asked just behind her. Penelope turned. It was a woman, a sales clerk, no doubt. She must have been alerted by all the sniffling and shuddering. Perhaps she had come to prevent her unhappy customer from dripping hot, salty tears on the books. The woman gazed at her with great sympathy and held out a clean pocket handkerchief.
"Thank you very much," Penelope said, taking it. She wiped her eyes and blew her nose and could not help noticing that the handkerchief had the letter L embroidered upon it.
"How odd,"
she mumbled through her sobs, not caring if the clerk understood her.
"At my school, we learned to embroider pocket handkerchiefs in just this way. I have lost all mine during my travels, unfortunately, else I would show you how similar they are, for my last name, too, begins with an L."
She looked up to find the sales clerk staring at her, open-mouthed. The woman's grey-green eyes brimmed with tears.
"Penelope?"
Her voice was no more than a whisper.
"Penelope Lumley, of the Swanburn Academy for Poor Bright Females."
"Why, yes." Sheer surprise stopped Penelope's crying at once. She stared at the woman's face. It had a familiar look to it. There was the same elfin chin as Cassiopeia, the poetic mouth of Beowulf, and the woman wore her hair just as Miss Mortimer did, in a pretty chignon at the base of her neck. Only the colour was different. It was not blonde like Miss Mortimer's, but a once vivid auburn that had been softened by time with strands of silver running through.
"Oh, how unlikely this is," the woman said, finding her voice. "And yet we must embrace the unexpected and not lose hope, as Charlotte never fails to remind me. Penny, my dear Penny, you must have found the clue I left for you. How clever you are."
"Clue? What clue?" Penelope felt woozy. The ground rolled beneath her feet as if it were her first day aboard ship. The woman reached out to steady her and let her hand rest on Penelope's arm.
"Penelope, do you know who I am?"
"She means to say, do you know who we are?"
A man appeared at the woman's side. He looked at Penelope with the same clear-eyed gaze as Alexander Incorrigible, though his eyes shone. Penelope took a deep, calming breath and looked from one eager, misty-eyed face to the other.
"If I am not mistaken," she said, with all the professionalism she could muster, "you are the long-lost Lumleys."
What a heartwarming scene burst into bloom. There were enough hugs and glad tears and cries of,
"Who would believe it?"
and,
"Did you ever?"
to bring 100 sentimental West End plays to a happy end. But it was strange, too, for Penelope had not seen her parents for such a very long time. And they also admitted that they found it strange, for the Penelope who stood before them was a young woman, albeit an oddly dressed one, and not the small child they had last seen many years before. Penelope's feelings were so mixed between joy and something far more bittersweet, one might easily have mistaken it for Christmas Day. There were so many questions to ask and answer, but there was one question Penelope needed settled on the spot. Even though she believed she already knew the truth, it felt both urgent and necessary that she heard it straight from the Lumleys' mouths, so to speak.
"Excuse me, that is, I must ask you about, well..."
Her lower lip trembled, and she could say no more. Matter Lumley gazed at her, soft-eyed as a cow.
"I expect you want to know where we have been all these years, and why we left you at Swanburn and did not come back."
"And why you did not hear from us year after year, not even on your birthday,"
Peter Lumley added. They both looked very sad. Penelope shook her head. Of course she did want to know these things, but all that could wait until later.
"What I most wish to know is this," she began. Her mother took her by both hands. "I know we have a great deal to explain, Penelope," Maida Lumley said. "We did what we did for your safety. Yet it must have been horribly difficult for you. I am so sorry."
"It was difficult for us too. But we are adults and made a choice. You were a child. With no say in the matter, I am sorry too."
Peter Lumley's voice was rough and soft at the same time.
"Well, the past cannot be changed," Penelope said after a moment,
which was true. Yet it meant a great deal to hear these words of apology from her parents. She felt her spirit grow lighter, as if a package she had been carrying for a long time could finally be put down.
Until someone invents a time machine, that is. And we are together now, which is more important. But the most important thing of all, she paused, unsure how to broach a topic so near to her heart, is a meal, no doubt. You must be starving. Come.
Mater Lumley stood and took her by the hand. Pater Lumley reached for the carpet bag.
Here, let me carry your albatross, he said, smiling. Why so many feathers? Were you trying to fly back to England?
The question she so desperately longed to ask withered on her tongue, as the very mention of England upset her all over again. Mater Lumley whispered something to her husband. He nodded, then went to the front door and turned over the Jufnet sign to Gay Schlussen to say that the bookstore was closed. Mater Lumley led Penelope through a short hallway at the back of the shop and up a flight of stairs to the apartment above the store. It was a lovely, sunny place with trailing green plants in the windows. The walls were lined with books and paintings, and there were embroidered pillows on every chair.
Just like a Swanburn, Penelope said,
which made her weep afresh, for had any Swanburn girl ever failed so miserably at her duties? Mater Lumley was a wise woman. She made no attempt to cheer Penelope or pepper her with questions or advice. Instead, she brought her a cozy blanket and went to the kitchen to put the kettle on. By this time, Pater Lumley had joined them upstairs. As they waited for the water to come to a boil, he assembled a truly excellent sliced apple, cheddar and mustard sandwich, one that would put old Timothy's best efforts to shame. Mater Lumley made Penelope a cup of tea, with milk and two sugars, just the way she liked it. And Pater Lumley put the sandwich on a pretty plate with a leaf and flower pattern all around the edges, much like the sign that had welcomed Penelope to Frankenford. Then they both sat quietly and waited. For as anyone who has ever tamed a wild thing knows, if one remains calm and friendly and offers a tasty treat, even a creature who has suffered a great shock will soon calm down enough to make friends. So it was with Penelope. Before long, her heart settled a bit, and with a nod of thanks, she reached for her food. One bite, and she was ravenous. After she had devoured it all, Mater Lumley produced a thick slice of black forest cake from the bakery next door. By the last forkful, Penelope had declared it the best meal she had eaten in her life. And Penelope had once dined at the Fern Court in London, run by the world-famous Chef Philippe, so this was high praise indeed. Now the words came in a flood. She told her parents all that had happened from the day of her arrival at Ashton Place to her terrible banishment to Plinkst, her daring escape from the Babushkinovs, her time at sea, and now this unexpected reunion in Frankenfurt. By the time she was done telling, it was evening. More sandwiches were served, with soup this time, and more tea and cake. The sunny apartment was now cozily dark and lit by the hearth-fire Pater Lumley carefully built and tended. Her parents had listened quietly all the way through and gave no sign of surprise, not even when Penelope explained that Edward Ashton was alive and determined to satisfy the curse upon the Ashtons by delivering Penelope and the Incorrigibles, all of whom seemed to be descended from Agatha Swanburn herself, though Penelope still did not know exactly how, to an untimely and gruesome end.
In doing so, he thinks he will save his side of the family tree from extinction. He told me so himself, she said miserably. But time is running out. The exact words of the curse are, in the fourth generation, the hunt begins and ends. One way or the other, the curse will end when Lady Constance's baby is born.
And not a moment sooner, either, Pater Lumley frowned in concentration.
It was an expression that would be familiar to anyone who had observed Penelope deep in thought.
No wonder Ashton's efforts have failed. The spirits beyond the veil have a taste for the theatrical. They want to be on hand for a spectacular event, a grand finale, if you will. When is the child expected?
The first full moon of May, scarcely a week from now. Penelope stared glumly at her hands. I will never get back to England in time. It is impossible. Her parents exchanged a look, the kind of look in which something is decided without a word being spoken. We must not lose hope, Mater Lumley said gently. As my grandmother said, when the impossible becomes merely difficult, that's when you know you've...
Your grandmother? Do you mean... Agatha Swanburn was my great-grandmother,
Penelope interrupted. Indeed she was. Mater Lumley rose from her chair. She stretched and yawned. It has been a remarkable day, and there is much to ponder, but even the most extraordinary days of our lives last no longer than the ordinary ones, and are rounded with a sleep, as Shakespeare wrote.
Yes, in The Tempest. Marvelous play. Yet I have always wondered why there are so many stories about shipwrecks, when so few of us are sailors.
Now Pater Lumley stood. He too yawned and stretched.
I will soon be rounded with a sleep myself. Let us go to bed, and leave the harder questions till tomorrow, when we are rested and can think better.
Her parents were right, of course. And not only because Shakespeare said so. Still, Penelope did not want the day or the conversation to end.
But Mater Lumley, Pater Lumley.
She stopped to stifle a yawn herself, for they are highly contagious, as the Lumley parents clearly knew.
I want to ask so many things. About our family tree, for example.
Mater Lumley smoothed back her hair with a hand, an elegant gesture that made Penelope think of Miss Mortimer.
I am sure you have many questions, my long-lost girl, but late bedtimes will do none of us any good. On the other hand,
Pater Lumley chuckled and went to stoke the fire, for clearly they would be up a little while longer.
On the other hand, you have gone a long time without answers,
his wife finished, taking a seat once more. Tonight, three questions only. The rest can wait till tomorrow.
Three?
Penelope frowned. How was she to winnow down her countless questions to a mere troika? Luckily, she had read enough of those wish-giving, genie-in-a-bottle stories to know not to ask a yes or no question, for those were always a waste.
All right, she said after considering it. My first question is, what happened to Agatha Ashton and her descendants after Pax threw her out?
Mater Lumley smiled.
The adventures of Agatha Ashton could fill a book. There are countless tales of her world travels, the remarkable people she met, and the things she learned. Too many to share now, though. Some day I will tell you them all.
At Penelope's disappointed look, she went on. But when Agatha was done traveling and had gained the kind of wisdom that is won only through broad-minded experience, she returned to England. There she met and married a man named Theodore Swanburn. They had a daughter named Theodora. She too grew up to be a fascinating woman, a scientist with a special interest in the nature of time. They say she even tried to invent a time machine. Penelope's eyes grew wide, but she knew better than to ask a second question by accident.
She very nearly succeeded too, or so she often claimed.
Theodora married a fellow scientist, Dr. Samuel Mortimer. He was a widower with a little girl of his own, not quite 2 years old. Sadly, his wife had died of a fever not long after the birth. The child's name was, and is, Charlotte.
Miss Charlotte Mortimer,
Penelope exclaimed. So that is how Agatha Swanburn became Miss Mortimer's grandmother.
Yes, Theodora was her stepmother, and she could not have asked for a better one. A few years later, Theodora and Samuel had another daughter.
And here she sits, your mother, Susanna.
Pater Lumley kissed his wife on the cheek and gave the fire another poke. Penelope shook her head in wonder. Imagine, her mother and Miss Mortimer.
children together. Maida Lumley drew her lap blanket round her. She was the very picture of cosiness and comfort. Charlotte and I were as close as sisters could be. We still are, though circumstances prevent us from seeing each other as often as we would like. Dreamy Susanna, she used to call me. Even as a child, I was fond of poetry. Charlotte was more of a practical type.
She is an excellent headmistress, Penelope said, in all seriousness. But for some reason, the remark made her parents laugh.
Well, I have no doubt of it, her mother said. You already know what became of Charlotte. As for me, I grew up and fell in love with a kind and talented man. She glanced warmly at her husband. And here he is, Hans Lumley, your father.
Hans Lumley, Penelope repeated softly. She had a sudden impulse. May I have some paper and a pencil? I would like to draw our family tree.
Peter Lumley chuckled as Mater Lumley answered.
Of course, but that is your second question.
Blast! Genies could be tricky, and so could parents, it seemed. At least she had one question left. A large sheet of drawing paper and a sharpened pencil were easily found among her father's art supplies. Penelope drew a circle with her own name right in the middle, and drew lines and boxes all around.
Hans Lumley is my father, she said, writing it in. My mother is Susanna Lumley, who has a half-sister, Charlotte Mortimer. She looked up.
That makes Miss Mortimer my aunt.
Correct. Mater Lumley got on the floor next to Penelope to help. My mother, Theodora, is your grandmother. She is still alive, though we see her rarely. She is quite an explorer. Her mother, Agatha Swanburn, was your great-grandmother, and Agatha's twin brother, Pax Ashton, was my great-granduncle.
The sudden onslaught of relatives made her head spin.
Edward Ashton is his son. That means Edward Ashton and I are some sort of cousins.
We shall have to let Cassiopeia and her abacus figure out which kind. Mater Lumley laid a hand on her arm.
Are you all right, Penny? You look pale. Shall I find some smelling salts?
I am quite well. Penelope stared at the paper, already covered with marks. After a moment's hesitation, she wrote Edward Ashton's name down beneath Pax's, for they were father and son. Then she drew a faint line between her name and his. Cousin, she wrote. The pencil hovered in the air.
And what about the incorrigible children? She asked.
Is that your third question?
Yes, for this was the question Penelope had wanted to ask all along.
Mater Lumley held her gaze a long time before she spoke.
Hans and I are the lucky Lumleys indeed. We have been blessed with four children.
Four clever, good-hearted, auburn-haired children, Peter Lumley added from his seat near the fire. And from what Charlotte has told us, you have been a perfectly wonderful big sister, Penelope. We are so very proud of you all.
Penelope had long known the answer in her heart, but hearing her own long-lost parents say it aloud was like a spring thaw at the South Pole. A lump in her heart that she had not even known was there began to melt, and the water flowed mostly from her eyes.
Mater Lumley hugged her and spoke in her ear. It is too much to explain now, but know that we did all we could to protect you. We hid you in plain sight at Swanburn in the care of family and friends. There you escaped Edward Ashton's notice for many years, thanks in part to the hare poultice. That was Charlotte's idea. We were not quite so lucky with the younger three. Edward Ashton snatched them away to serve his own terrible schemes, although I believe he will fail in the end. As you see, Providence has cared for all four of you very well. So far.
Old Timothy was a great help too, Peter Lumley remarked. The man makes a decent sandwich, if I do say so myself.
One would have thought Penelope would have run out of tears by now, but she wept again with joy and grief and wonder until she had soaked her own pocket handkerchief and several of her parents's too.
"We are all one family," she said, gazing at the family tree written out before her. "I am an Ashton, and a Swanburn, and a Lumley, and an Incorrigible." She blew her nose. "But Edward Ashton believes there is a fifth."
Mater Lumley's eyes grew wide.
"I beg your pardon?"
"The Wolf's Curse said there were 5 murdered cubs to be avenged. Edward Ashton believes his efforts have failed because he has only found 4 of us. He is convinced that you have had another child."
"Well, that is unexpected."
Mater Lumley's voice stayed light-hearted, even as her cheeks went pale.
"It is bad news that he thinks so, Penelope. We must act quickly, for he will be searching for us now."
A dreadful feeling rose in Penelope then, sharp and cold as a plunge into a frozen sea. It was the iced-over, heartless feeling that enables some people to do terrible things for what they believe are perfectly justifiable reasons. But then, she thought,
this must be how Edward Ashton feels all the time. And she took a long, deep breath, and then another, and waited until the feeling passed.
Her nose filled with the aroma of good tea and excellent cake, and her mother's lavender-scented perfume, mixed with the pleasant, burning wood smell from the fire that her father was tending even now. It was the smell of family, and now that she had breathed deeply of it, she knew she would never be without it again, no matter what.
She stood determined. "I must get back to England, and to the Incorrigibles," she said. "There is a fortune-teller there, an expert on curses and all things supernatural, who may be able to help us yet. But there is not much time." She looked from one parent to the other. "I know it is far, but there must be a way."
Her parents exchanged a glance.
"There is a way," her father said.
"Well, what on earth is it?"
Penelope blurted, annoyed. Honestly, they were being as enigmatic as old Timothy.
"What on earth, indeed?" her father said.
Now he was smiling.
"The answer is plain as the paintings on the wall."
"Paintings?"
She looked around at the art-filled apartment.
"What do paintings have to do with it?"
Mater Lumley cocked her head to one side, just as Cassiopeia Incorrigible would have done.
"My dear Penny," she said, eyes twinkling, "I hope you are not afraid of heights."
The 12th chapter. Made happy by the verdant scene. Parents. They could be mysterious and maddening. Also, Penelope was quickly learning. Over her protests, bedtime was declared, for she had used up her 3 questions, and that, as the elder Lumleys said, was that. Her father fashioned a cozy nest out of blankets, and her mother offered one of her own night dresses to wear, and an embroidered pillow that read, "The difference between a dream and a plan is a to-do list." It was an experience common to most childhoods, though new to Penelope, that of drifting off to sleep as her parents spoke quietly in another room, trying not to be overheard. The comforting, murmuring sound was like the lap of waves against the hull of a watertight ship, and she slept as well as she ever had in her life. She awoke to find her cabin boy's trousers and warm knit sweater on the foot of her bed, neatly folded and smelling of fresh soap and wood smoke. They must have been washed and hung near the fire overnight to dry. She bathed and dressed quickly, for she wanted to look at those paintings in the morning light. Plain as the paintings on the wall. Afraid of heights? What could Pater and Mater Lumley have meant? Her parents were already up. The kitchen smelled marvellous of coffee and shaving soap and lavender water, and a hot breakfast cooked by one's own mother. Penelope peeked into the pot on the stove, porridge with jam, excellent, but turned her attention to the walls.
"Don't you like porridge?" her mother asked. "I do, very much, but first I intend to examine these paintings." She stood in front of the nearest one with a look of deep concentration on her face. Peter Lumley chuckled. He had finished his meal and was now at the kitchen counter, making sandwiches.
"I'll offer a hint if you like."
"No, thank you." Penelope's eyes were fixed on the painting. "I took several art appreciation classes at Swanburn and did rather well, I'm proud to say. If there is some hidden meaning to be found, I will find it." She finished looking and moved on to the next painting, then the next. "They are landscapes," she said after examining a dozen. "Lovely ones, too, but there is nothing symbolic. No mythological figures, either."
"Hmm," her father said, cutting the sandwiches into perfect triangles.
Major Lumley sipped her coffee with a look of private amusement. Penelope folded her arms and squinted, then made a telescope out of her cupped hands, but to no avail. "To see past the obvious, I must look the way the incorrigibles sniff," she thought. She concentrated afresh, wholeheartedly and without distraction, and drew all the powers of her attention together, as if weaving many thin strands into a mighty rope, strong enough to hold a ship at anchor.
"Eureka!" she exclaimed at last. "Although they depict a variety of landscapes, each of these paintings uses the same point of view."
As the art critics among you know, point of view simply means where the painter has imagined him or herself to be in relation to the picture. For example, a picture of a person in a barrel might be drawn as if one were outside the barrel looking in, or inside the barrel looking out. It is the painter's artistic license that makes such feats possible, just as poetic license lets poets write convincingly about terrible shipwrecks and storms at sea without getting the least bit wet.
"Point of view, eh?"
Peter Lumley wrapped the sandwiches in clean napkins, ready for a picnic.
"Tell me more."
"See, the painter is in the air." Penelope stepped closer and gestured at the canvas. "One might even call it a bird's eye view. The green meadow stretches out below like a carpet, and those little dots of white, is that Edelweiss, are like points of light." She turned to him. "Did you once live on a very high mountain?"
"Yes, but there is more to it than that," he said, with maddening mysteriousness.
Her mother interjected. "Eat your porridge, Penny. We will be leaving very soon." Penelope was hungry and glad to obey. Her parents made quick preparations together without needing to say a word, as if they had done it many times before. Soon there were two good-sized rucksacks packed full and propped against the wall, each cleverly designed to strap onto a person's back. Mater Lumley opened Penelope's feathered carpet bag, placed the sandwiches inside, and fastened it shut. Mater Lumley looked at her husband.
"We should go as soon as Penny is done with breakfast," she said quietly. "I have that cold, prickly feeling down the back of my neck. He cannot be far."
Peter Lumley nodded.
"Time to pull down the curtain," he said,
and disappeared outside. Penelope finished swallowing and wiped her lips with a napkin.
"What curtain?" she asked. "Where are we going? He cannot be far. Do you mean Edward Ashton? I think you must."
"Three questions, all at once," Mater Lumley answered in mock dismay.
"Well, all right. The third question you have answered yourself. As for the second, we are going where we are urgently needed, and faster than you can imagine." "England!" Penelope exclaimed. "And the curtain?"
Mater Lumley moved the rucksacks to the top of the stairs, as if that brought them one step closer to leaving.
"Your father and I live in Frankenford only part of the year. We stay as long as it takes to sell enough books and paintings to tide us over the rest of the time. He has devised a way to make sure no one bothers the shop while we are elsewhere. It involves a curtain," she smiled. "Your father has a knack for stagecraft, I think." Naturally, Penelope wanted to ask where elsewhere might be, and how on earth they were going to get to England so quickly, and whether by any chance her theatrically inclined father had ever heard of a young playwright named Simon Harley Dickinson. But Pater Lumley had bounded back upstairs, and there was no more time for questions.
"All done,"
he said. He put on an extra warm coat, as if he expected to be going someplace cold, and strapped on a rucksack. Pater Lumley did the same. To Penelope, she said, "There is a coat and hat in your carpet bag, and food and water. It's a bit heavier than it was,